You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Kristen Higgins.
Thank you for tuning into Author Stories. We have a fantastic show for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com where you can subscribe to the show on your favorite podcasting platform. You can find links to it there at HankGarner.com. I'd like to tell you about some sponsors before we get started today. The Clockwork Detective, Constable of Aquiline, Book 1 by R.A. McCandless. Aubrey Hartman left the Imperial battlefields with a pocket full of medals, a fearsome reputation, and a clockwork leg. The Imperium diverts her trip home to investigate the murder of a young druid in a strange town. She is ordered to not only find the killer, but prevent a full-scale war with the dreaded Fae. Meanwhile, the arrival of a sinister secret policeman threatens to dig up Aubrey's own secrets, ones that could ruin her career. It soon becomes clear that Aubrey has powerful enemies with plans to stop her before she gets started. Determined to solve the mystery, Aubrey must survive centaurs, thugs, and a monster of pure destruction. You need to check out this exciting new series from R.A. McCandless, Steampunk Meets Urban Fantasy and The Clockwork Detective. The Zombie Road Omnibus, The Roadkill Collection by David Simpson. Buckle up, it's gonna get bloody. Get the Zombie Road box set featuring the first three books in the award-winning Zombie Road series for over 1,100 pages of action-packed, suspense-filled, post-apocalyptic fiction. Includes Convoy of Carnage, Bloodbath on the Blacktop, Rage on the Rails. If you're looking for an apocalyptic thrill ride filled with everyday people, heroes, villains, and a dog named Bob, then look no further. Full of thought-provoking ideas that cover uncharted territory in post-apocalyptic fiction, this series will keep you rooting for the good guys, despising the bad, and turning the pages until the very end. The Zombie Road Omnibus, The Roadkill Collection by David Simpson. Homefront, an Expeditionary Force audio drama special from Craig Allenson. A full cast performance of a thrilling new episode in the New York Times best-selling Expeditionary Force series. After the latest mission of the starship Flying Dutchman, Earth is safe, not just for a year, but for hundreds of years. The ship's weary crew wonders what they will do with their lives in the peacetime, but the enemy has other plans, and there's danger on the home front. Starring Zachary Quinto, R.C. Bray, Kate Mulgrew, Robert Picardo, and everyone's favorite AI, Skippy the Magnificent, alongside a full cast. Includes plenty of pew 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 original sound composition and maybe some singing by R.C. Bray. Homefront, an Expeditionary Force audio drama special by Craig Allenson. Now stay tuned for the show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Kristen Higgins on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book called Life and Other Inconveniences. And this is one of those books that when you read it, when you finish it, it will stay with you for a long time, maybe in a lifetime. Welcome to the show, Kristen.
Thank you so much, Hank. It's so nice to be here.
I am really excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
That's a great question. I never wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a pediatric surgeon, and that career path is not going so well. I went to college intending to be pre-med and quickly learned that I didn't have the right kind of intellect for that. And I never consciously wanted to be a writer, but I always told stories to myself as a kid, as a teenager. You know, I didn't want The Hobbit to end, so I kept telling chapters to myself. You know, I never wrote anything down though. As a teenager, it was Gone with the Wind. I was going to fix that couple,
right.
Scarlett and Rhett.
Exactly.
And then when I had children, I told them stories all the time. I did not believe in devices in the car, and they just had to listen to mommy or look out the window. And they loved hearing my stories about, bunny rabbits or badgers or two children who looked a lot like them. And so I told stories a lot. And it was when my kids were little that I decided to give a try at writing an actual novel. And again, I had worked in advertising, but that was about as much fiction as I had ever done before. I'd never written short stories or even kept a journal. And I think in a way that really served me well, that I was ignorant about what it took to write a novel, and also confident that I could do that. And I think there's a Mark Twain quote that says, you need two things to be a writer, and it's ignorance and confidence. And I had both.
I love that.
So I thought, I've read a lot of books, and how hard could it be to write one? And so I gave myself a deadline, too. I thought, if I can write a book before my younger child, my son, starts all-day school, then I won't go back to work, outside of the home, because I was a stay-at-home mom, and that was such a joy to me. So I had, I think, 3 years to write and sell a book, and I decided to write a book about sort of an ordinary person, the kind of person that you would live next door to, or your sister, or, your friend down the street, and give her a romantic comedy. And I thought, that's the kind of book that will sell. I think, everybody likes to laugh and feel good about themselves at the end of a book. So I wrote it, and it was such a joyful experience. It was such an innocent time. I didn't belong to any writers' organizations, or I didn't know any published authors. And so I had that lovely ignorance phase that Mark Twain speaks about. And when I was finished with it, it took me about 6 months to write that first book, but I revised it for another year because I knew it had to be really good to sell as a debut novel. So I read all the great authors in my genre, that romantic comedy, contemporary romance, and I kept revising my book until I felt like it was really ready for prime time. And I sent it out, and I got an agent and a contract actually a year before my deadline. And I've been writing ever since. So it was a combination of luck and timing and that sort of confidence that I was where I needed to be.
That's an amazing story. Let's rewind for just a minute. When you were young, and you said that you just always had the storytelling thing, excuse me, about you. Were there any other storytellers in your family? Did you come from a strong family of storytellers, or was this your own thing?
I definitely come from a family of storytellers. My dad also told us stories to keep us entertained, and in the car, or at night during thunderstorms, he was if we lost power, he would tell us stories by candlelight. And I have this big Hungarian family of aunts and uncles, and I was lucky enough to know my grandparents well into my 40s before they passed away, and everyone was a storyteller. And I think what I loved the most as a kid was to listen. And I think that's a really important skill to have as an author. You don't just tell the stories, you have to hear them too. And so there I was, hiding in the corner of the kitchen or sitting under the table while the adults told their stories. And I loved it. It was magical.
There's nothing like being able to sit and absorb the conversations of older family members and hearing those stories go back and forth. I think that really does something to kids to help them be in tune with the language of story.
Mm-hmm. And also to appreciate other perspectives.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that I recall most is that I would often hide in order to hear the adults talk and, you know, to hear their points of view and their humanness when they talked about, you know, without a little kid in the room, to hear them complain or discuss, you know, why things were hard at the moment. You know, I don't think they would have done that if they'd known I was there. And so I think it broadened my worldview to look at the adults as not just there to take care of me, but also people in their own right.
Exactly. You gave yourself this deadline to work with. Had you ever seriously considered before that, you know, picking up your pen or your laptop and writing down a story? Had it never been on your radar before that this was something that you wanted to pursue?
Well, you know, in those early years of motherhood, I was alone a lot. We live in a rural area and my house isn't close by neighbors. And so it was just me and the kids. My husband was a firefighter and he worked another job besides. So to keep myself company, I would make up stories. And that's when I started to think, you know, maybe I should write these down. And so it was almost born of loneliness, but in the sweetest way. You know, I needed adult friends. There
right.
weren't any around.
So you made some.
So I made them up. And it was during a very happy time of my life, too, because, you know, I really loved being a mom and you know, was lucky to have a husband who would work two jobs so that I could stay home those first few years. And so when I got so involved in the stories in my head, I started to think about, maybe I should give this a try.
That's fantastic. So what was that first book that you wrote and sold?
It was called Fools Rush In, named by my publisher. It really didn't have any rushing or fools in it, but it was a cute title. And it was the story of a woman who moves back to her hometown on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. She is fresh out of medical school and residency, and she is determined to win the man whom she has loved since the age of 14. And she feels she knows more about him because she's rather stalked him in a very benign way throughout the years. So she knows about the dog he rescued and that he helps his grandmother and that kind of thing. And she thinks, I just have to, you know, get his attention and then he'll see that I'm really worthy of him. And of course he turns out not to be the hero of the story. You know, it's someone else who's loved her all along. But I wanted to write a story about regular people and give them really fun, funny, memorable love stories, because I felt at the time there were too many books about vampires or Navy SEALs or dupes or Navy SEAL vampires, you know? and I thought, you know, what about the rest of us? Can't we just have a lovely story, you know, for the rest of us? And that's where the timing factor of a writer's success came in. It was kind of a new thing to write about small towns at the time that I started, and a few other authors and I hit at the same time, and readers really responded to it. And this is one of those things you can't predict. You know, it was 2006 when my first book came out, late 2006, and we were at war and, you know, still getting over 2001, you know, 9/11, and still dealing with the fallout of that. And I think people needed a simpler world, and small towns gave that to them. It was a safe place, you know, with all this tumult in the world. And so small town romance and romantic comedy became a thing. And I was lucky enough to be, you know, kind of at the forefront of that. But very quickly, my writing started to morph into what we call women's fiction or domestic fiction, where it's a little less about the couple and a little bit more about the individuals and the things they have to overcome. So that the stories are bigger and encompass more issues and difficulties than just finding the right guy or woman, and living happily ever after.
Yeah. In looking for, you know, what the common thread in all of your stories, it seems to me that you really focus on the humanity of the characters, and it kind of goes back to what you said about hiding under the table and listening to adult mm-hmm. conversations. It's finding those common things and how we respond to those, and it seems that is a driving factor in a lot of your stories.
Absolutely, yeah. I love to really look deeply at the characters and not just present them as they are, but understand what happens to make them the person they are. So I love to know everything about my characters, how they grew up, how many siblings they had, where they went to school, what was the best thing that happened to them, what was the worst thing that happened to them. And rather than just present them as they are, to really know all those things that made them, even like in Life and Other Inconveniences, there's a rather horrible character named Clark, and he's Genevieve's son and Emma's father. And he abandons both his daughters. They're very far apart in age, and one has special needs. And he's just this vacuous, shallow, selfish idiot. And yet, to present him as only that, you think, like, how were you made? You know, what made you into this jerk, you know, this absolute jerk? And to explore that and think, what would it be like to grow up as this woman's son, having lost a brother, having lost a father at a young age? And, you know, how do you respond to those things? So I try to look very deeply at each character, and I'm really thrilled that you said that's the common thread, that humanity. That makes me very happy.
Every good story is driven by conflict and some sort of drama. When you're telling stories about, you know, small towns and relationships, where do you look to bring in that tension to the story that drives us forward?
You know, I think I look to other people. I, as I said, I'm a listener, and I also have this this face that makes people tell stories. And I look very much like my mom, and she has the same effect on people, where people just talk to us, and I'm so grateful for that. But I remember sitting in a restaurant waiting to be seated, waiting for my friends to join me. And this lady sat down next to me, and she said, I said, "Hi, how are you?" And she said, "My husband is cheating on me, and I just found out. And I always thought I'd leave him if that ever happened, but now that the moment is here, I don't know what to do." And I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And sure enough, I end up writing a book about about just that. You know, I wanted to say, like, hand her my card and say, "Mind if I call you?" But that would have been uncaring, you know. But it was just such a wonderful, tragic, fascinating conundrum of, you know, she had two little kids, and she thought she had a line in the sand, but now that he'd crossed it, was she actually going to say, "Okay, get out, we're done"? You know, how hard is that when you have little kids? And it was so interesting. So I try to keep my ears out for those kind of stories, even if it's something on television or something I overhear on the train, or, you know, something that someone tells me, "Oh, I haven't spoken to my grandmother in 17 years." There's a big story there, you know? And I love that that human drama. You know, I don't want to write books about the world ending or alien invasion or, you know, battles against dragons, although I enjoy reading them. For me, what is most interesting is the drama that everybody lives out and deals with in their lives.
Right. Well, Kristen, when you begin a new story and your new project that you're working on, and you're at that beginning stage where everything is possible and nothing mm-hmm. is set in stone yet, what comes to you first? Is it a character? Is it a situation that you overhear, like you just told us about? Is it a news headline? Is it a place? Like, what usually kicks off the creative process for you?
For me, it's often a character, but usually a character in a situation, you know. So I think about, you know, what if you were estranged from your very wealthy, famous grandmother and your own child had never met her? That would be the beginning of Life and Other Inconveniences. You know, what if your friend died suddenly and left you the list of things you wanted to do that you'd made when you were 17? And that's the start of Good Luck With That, last year's book. So I start with a situation, and then I try to put in the characters who are going to struggle the most in that, because as you said, conflict is what drives the story and makes the story so rich and interesting. So why would it be so hard to come back home, or why would it be so difficult to tackle that list? And I build from there. I generally spend a couple of months shaping the story before I start writing chapter one, writing sentences, you know. I like to have that plan, at least those, you know, those lampposts along the road where I can see where I'm going. And then about halfway through the first draft, that outline or that plan gets tossed to the wayside, and I feel like I know where I'm going enough to drive on my own.
Well, the new book, Life and Other Inconveniences, which is available everywhere now, it tackles some dark subject matter, some really intense characters and situations, and at the same time has a lightheartedness to it, a sweetness to it, if you will. It's mm-hmm. not ha-ha-ha funny, but there were plenty of times that I catch myself smiling and, you know, that there's a certain levity that comes with it that mm-hmm. that lets us as the reader off the hook every now and then from just being a dismal story.
Oh, yeah.
Is that something that you think about in the writing, you know, that, okay, this has gotten really deep and dark, I need to turn the corner a little bit, or is that something that just naturally comes out of following these characters around?
I think it's natural. You know, I would not want to read this book without humor in it, without, you know, funny conversations and offbeat characters. And I definitely choose them to lighten the mood, bring some humor into it, you know, because I don't want to read a sad and depressing book. And yet I do want to examine those difficult issues that we all have to deal with, because I think it's important to. I think that's my job as a writer, to delve into those common human issues that we will all deal with. And in the case of Life and Other Inconveniences, the issue is loss and how it defines you. Will it ruin you, or will it elevate you to be a better, more loving person? And how do you get there? You know, everyone in the world will lose someone dear to them before they're ready. And that's going to carve your heart in some way. In Genevieve's case, it makes her harder and sharper. In Emma's case, it makes her more loving and more generous and kinder. So to explore those issues without the occasional laugh and smile, it would be too much to ask of my readers. So I think, you know, it is a trademark of mine is my tagline is laugh, cry, laugh again. You know, I want you to have that full experience, you know, that roller coaster ride where you are crying and in one chapter and then laughing in the next.
Kristen, most authors have similar themes that you can trace across all of their books, maybe similar genre. Most of the time it's similar genres, similar character traits that pop up in their books. How would you say Life and Other Inconveniences is different from other stories that you've written? How does it stand apart?
Well, I think in some ways it's a bigger story than I've written in the past. It's the story of a multi-generational family and also the tragedies that they've dealt with in their lives and the issues that they need to resolve before it's too late, before Genevieve dies. You know, it is a book about life and death, but it's also a gentle story. It's a story that it's a love story, and it's not just a romantic love story. It's a love story about mothers and daughters and friends and the family that you create. It's a story of redemption and forgiveness. So those themes are big and meaty. And yet at its core, the message that I've always had through every book I've written is the same. And that is peel everything away and you're still enough. You know, get rid of the trappings and the pretenses and the posturing and the eagerness to please, and the person that you are is absolutely enough and deserving of acceptance and love.
That is a fantastic message. We talk about the family that we create, and a lot of times when we use a term like that, we're talking about friends who become as close as family, and we build this support structure, especially when we're old enough to move out from our parents, and you start, you know, building friends who become close as family. But an interesting thing about this book, and we've mentioned it a few times, is that this is blood family who has to figure out how to be family. Mm-hmm. Again. That's a tough thing. When we're talking about family that we had no choice in having, but then making the choice to be family in the face of all of that, that had to be tough subject matter to tackle.
It is, and you put it so beautifully. You know, I think it's easy in today's society and with social mores to say, like, this person wasn't good to me, really hurt me, I'm done with them. And there's nothing wrong with saying that if they really are a person who can do damage to you. But in Emma's case, she chooses to try to make amends with her grandmother and bring her child along for that lesson. She's very protective, but she's also there. She shows up. And I think it shows like a great capacity of love and forgiveness in that character, just that she's willing to try. Yeah, it is, you know, a family who has to learn how to be a family because they've never really connected on that fundamental loving level that you hope you have with your family of origin.
Right. The new book, Life and Other Inconveniences. One other question, Kristen. What is it that you love about dogs?
What is there not to love about dogs, Hank?
Talk about consistent themes across books. Yes. There always seems to be a canine somewhere.
Well, I am a dog person and a sucker for a rescue. So I have dogs. I've always had dogs. And I think that, you know, when you have a pet, your choice of pet, choice of the pet's name, breed, whatever it is, says something about you. And the fact that in her old age, Genevieve has adopted 5 unruly, poorly behaved dogs says a lot about where she's come from and who she wants to be now.
Yeah. Well, I absolutely love the book, Kristen. We're going to send everyone to pick up a copy of it. There's going to be a link to it where you can buy it in the show notes of this episode. If people are just learning about you and want to dig into your back catalog and follow along with your blog and all of that good stuff, is there a place they can connect with you online?
Yes, there is. It's my website, kristenhiggins.com, and all my social media links are there. So I would love people to pop over.
And we'll link up all of that in the show notes and in one handy place where people can find it all. Kristen, this has been so much fun chatting. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Hank. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
They reverently slipped Jason's giant-size X-Men number one from its Mylar protector. Drinking in the sweet aroma of browning paper and three-color process that signals only the best and rarest and most wonderful of collectibles. On one page, Professor X raised his fingers to his temples and rallied his X-Men, his psychic commands radiating from his bald head like waves off hot asphalt. "I have psychic powers," Owen blurted. "I want Wolverine's claws," Jason was turning a page. "Snicked! Or, hey, get this, lightsabers poking out the backs of my hands, or even, no, I'm totally serious. I have psychic powers." "No, you don't." "I do." Jason laid the comic on the bedspread. He sighed. Owen could be such a spaz sometimes. "Okay," he said indulgently. "What number am I thinking of?" "Stop, it doesn't work that way. What I can do is called a psychic reading, off an object, like getting impressions. When the doorbell rings, if I put my hand on the knob, as soon as I do, I know who's there."
"It's called looking through the peephole, moron."
"Shut up! And when I touch the phone, I know who's calling."
"I'm sure, Mr. Bullshit from Bullshit Mountain.
Like my sister or my grandmother, I just know it's them."
"There's no such thing as psychics."
"Okay, you try."
"Don't be stupid."
"Are you chicken?"
"Fine."
"Okay."
He snatched up a brown paper bag, spotted with grease, and dumped a few stale French fries into the trash can.
"I'll put an object in this bag, and you try to guess what it is. Turn your back."
Jason did, and heard a rustling behind his head.
"Okay, you can look now."
Owen produced the bag. It was rounded with some object now.
"Don't touch yet, just think. Try to imagine what's inside."
"Your lunch?" Jason sneered, but he closed his eyes and tried to imagine. He could hear Owen's breathing. Jason's nose itched. His brain grew bored with nothing to look at, and fragments of images swam in and out of his imagination. "Strawberry," he blurted. Owen reached into the bag, producing a white bowl. Jason had eaten Frosted Flakes from it about 3 days ago. A few stuck to it, like little beige fish scales. "See? I lose."
"No, look here."
Owen pointed. A design went around the sides of the bowl. A long string of vines and painted fruit. With strawberries.
"That's..." Jason began, but didn't know how to end the sentence. "It's cool. See? What did I tell you? Do it again."
Jason closed his eyes. An image like daisies and sun and... "Yellow," he blurted after 3 seconds.
"Oh my God, open your eyes!"
Owen held a bright yellow highlighter pen.
"I hadn't even put it in the bag!"
And so they went, for 30 minutes or more. A staple remover, a toy soldier, a sweat sock, a pencil. Jason never said precisely what was in the bag, but it was always close or related. He'd imagine a cockpit, and Owen would produce a game controller. He'd say, "plate," and the object would be a CD. He made right angles with his pointer fingers, shrugging, only to have Owen pull out Eliza's knitting needles. His friend became more and more enthusiastic, but Jason became a little scared.
"You have a real gift," Owen said. "You're, like, brilliant."
Owen babbled for a long time about astral projection and ESP, how Jason was picking up signals from Owen's own psychic powers, which had obviously been doing the broadcasting. Owen left that night full of plans and experiments, vindicated in his beliefs.
Jason sat on the bed after Owen left, thinking hard. He had no explanation for what he'd done, but he knew he hadn't faked it. He couldn't believe, but he couldn't deny, either.